With us today is Jason Boyer, N6EY. Have I got your call sign right?
Yes, you do, Ted.
Well, he's kind of got a story to tell because he's the main guy behind M Squared. And a lot of you folks may be familiar with this company. I had heard the name, and I had seen some things, but I was never really, I guess I want to say, I never took an in-depth look at M Squared's website. I was not totally aware of what they did. And matter of fact, for the most part, I had a little misinformation given to me, and so I was just assuming certain things. But I'm so glad to have you on with us, because we've been talking about some things on QSO with some folks, and there seems to be a thread running through here, and that is there's a lot of interest right now in satellite communication, and there also seems to be a lot of interest in EME. I'm hearing more and more people ask questions about it, and it seems like folks that have been really, how I want to say, sitting on the edge of their chairs thinking, that's probably too difficult for me. A lot of those folks are starting to ask questions. So now I go up to your website, and it looks to me like, you know, it looks to me like for somebody that wants to do satellite and EME, your website's like a paradise. You know, it's, you can find everything and anything that you need up there. And I kind of wanted to pick your brain a little bit. But first, I want you to tell me a little bit about M Squared, who you are, how you got started in this business, and what was the beginnings of all this.
Well, I tell you, Ted, I appreciate the accolades. I'm merely just heading up the amateur radio sales and marketing part of this company. The real guy behind M Square is Mike Stahl, K6MYC, and you may know his name from or recognize the name from a previous company that he had, a very very well known antenna manufacturer, KLM. He was the M in KLM. So a number of years after KLM was bought out, he left the company, and a couple of years later, actually started M Square Antennas. And early on, one of the first things that M Square did was to fulfill some outstanding orders when KLM went out of business. So there's a kind of a misnomer that KLM became M Square. We simply started with Mike as the engineer, and we were fortunate to get the M from KLM.
For those that are not real familiar with KLM, I'm familiar with the brand name, but why don't you describe the antenna line that they were producing at the time, or what they
made,
or they most remembered for, I guess.
KLM was famous for a few antennas, most notably the KT series of tri-banders. There was the KT-34 and the KT-34X, which later became the KT-34A and KT-34XA. And many of those antennas, even 30, 35 years later, are still in service. A significant portion of our business is providing upgrade kits for those antennas and bringing them up to the current specs, which M Square has now as the KT-34M2 and the KT-36XA. So they're it's a little bit we've kind of evolved the product and made it better, stronger, and faster, so to speak.
Well, for those that might have KLM antennas, what do these upgrades do for the antennas that they may own?
Well, the KLM upgrades actually make a little bit better connection mechanically for the on the shorting bars. Some of the hardware on the KLM antennas in its day was good hardware, but over time works loose and everything. M Square, one of the things that M Square brought to antenna manufacturing was the use of CNC or computer numerically controlled machining processes. And what that allows us to do is to efficiently and inexpensively manufacture parts for antennas that are solid, that won't fall apart, that that have a lot closer and more repeatable tolerances. So you end up getting a better product.
So how is that different, let's say, than conventional antenna design and assembly? I mean, how does that fare up? I guess I want to say explain the differences in that. I mean, it's one thing to say computer aided or computer generated or whatever, but in the terms that, you know, us CB operators would want to know, what differences does that make to us on the receive end? You know, here we are putting an antenna up. What differences are you going to notice?
Well, one of the differences that you'll notice is that the antenna stands up a lot better to wind, to weather, even to corrosion, because tolerances are a lot tighter. Parts fit together more snugly. The older processes used, they tended to use a sheet metal process where you have bent or formed sheet metal products that kind of fit together. But if you can bend the metal, if it can be bent into shape, it can be bent out of shape. With these processes, we actually take a block or a billet of aluminum and machine them to fit exactly, and that gives you a much stronger connection.
Well, when something's up in the air, I know working in the broadcast business, when something is at the top of a tower, people on the ground are just not aware of the environment that goes on up there. And I recall seeing one of our tower climbers, John Hedish, that works for Middle Tennessee Two-Way, come down off of a tower with an antenna bay, a broadcast bay made by, I think it was Jampro. And this thing, I mean, it was like, well, what in the world bent that all to pieces? I mean, you know, and I mean, the thing was distorted, looked horrible. I thought, you know, what would do that? What would bend that metal like that and deform it in such a way? And of course, I don't know, hail, wind, that environment up there at the top of the tower is a completely different world from what you're living with here on the ground. And if you can imagine leaving something just outside in the weather is enough stress, but put it at the top of a 100-foot tower, you know, or a 60, even a 60-foot tower, it's a different world up there than on the ground.
Absolutely. A lot of people don't realize that when an antenna or a rotator is at the top of a tower, even the tower itself, it's constantly exposed to winds and forces that from precipitation, just the weight of snow and ice. It's not a static environment up there. It's constantly changing, and it constantly puts stress and wear on fatigue on products. So you will find that after a number of years, even if you aren't moving the tower, moving the rotator as much as you think you are, they're going to still get beat up. So yeah, you do see a lot of wear and tear that you wouldn't imagine would happen.
Well, what was happening with the broadcast antennas is the extreme hot and cold. They'd maybe get a hairline crack in them, and then water would run in, and then during the wintertime that water would freeze and it would split the element from the outside in. I mean, in other words, the element would be full of ice on the inside and they would freeze, and then the copper would actually crack or get a crack running all down the center of it, and of course then that would weaken it. And as that went on over a period of time, you'd wind up with these elements that look like they'd been over by a Mack truck, you know. So, you know, and you think, how did that happen, you know? But there's processes. So when you say that an antenna is designed better, you know, built better, tighter, better waterproofing, and all those kind of things, it may not seem like a whole lot up front, but the point is, you know, if you're buying something, you're paying the money for it. And, you know, once you make a few trips up a tower to work on an antenna, that gets old pretty quick. So, you're better off buying something that's going to last, that you're not going to have to go up there and climb and, you know, be taking it down and servicing it and all that kind of stuff. Once you put it up there, you want it to stay, and you want to be able to use the thing, you know, talk on the radio or use the or CW, whatever it is that you do. You want to be able to do that without having to worry or think about that antenna up there being compromised, you know. I talked to a gentleman here not too long ago, and he said, you know, it's a funny thing. He said, my antenna, my rotor's out. He said, I can't turn the rotor, you know. And he was just dreading the fact that he's going to have to go up that tower and pull that rotor down and work on it. You know, so and, go ahead.
And as the average age of hams start to climb, you realize that a lot of the guys that you know used to climb their own towers now can't do so. So they have to spend money on sending someone up a tower, and that may be the biggest part of putting up an antenna system is the labor to install it.
Yeah, and you know that's something too. The other thing is that, especially with hams getting older, you know, is the fact that climbing itself is a hazard. I mean, every once in a while, you'll hear stories of guys putting antennas up and getting caught up in a high voltage line somewhere that they never suspected, or something falls and they don't give it a whole lot of thought. So, I mean, I think the least amount of activity at the top of a tower for all hams, the better off. The better off
absolutely.
You are.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, that's really why, you know, a lot of people look at the price of an antenna and immediately go to the least expensive and don't look at the quality and don't look at the performance and don't realize that, you know, if you pay a little more for quality, the result is a small investment in the quality of the materials results in a lot less hassle, a lot less frustration in climbing up the tower. Like you say, after just a year or two up in the air, the antenna doesn't get as worn. You don't have as many trips up the tower. You end up saving money in the long run.
Yeah, and of course it's of course the joy of operation without the apprehension. You know, you're not on the ground thinking, boy, if I could just get up there and tighten that up, if I could just get up there and bend this back in shape, if you know, and this would be performing a lot better. So you're in the middle of a QSO, and all the while you're thinking to yourself, this thing's compromised. You know, if I could just get up there and straighten it out, you know,
absolutely.
You know, all right. Now let me ask a question. Tell me a little bit. I'd like to know a little bit about your ham radio career. Where did you first hear about this hobby? And what drew you into it?
Wow, it was a number of years ago. I can remember being about 7 or 8 years old, and one Christmas, my parents, you know, I was really into science, really into just anything that involved gadgets and everything, and it got this little electronics kit, and actually one of the first projects I built was a crystal radio. And picking up my first AM broadcast, I was hooked. That was it. And from there, it progressed to shortwave receivers. And my grandfather and great grandfather were both amateurs, going back into the days of Spark. So you might say that it's in the blood. I was kind of predestined for it. But I've been a licensed ham now for 25 years. And that actually led to a career in the Navy as a avionics technician, and all the while being involved with the Mars program in my off-duty time and amateur radio. And eventually, in my civilian career, that led to a position with M Square.
I guess if you've got that extensive of a background, going all the way back to relatives doing Spark stuff, I guess that would pretty well near put you on the path if you had any inclination or interest at all. You know, it's almost destiny in your case. In other words, you had a little choice. You know, once the bug hits you, it's very difficult to get distracted from it. There's something so much, I guess I want to say, magical about amateur radio. There's something about it that is like no other hobby, what do you think that is? You know what?
Well, you know, I think it's all about the people. It's the human connection. No matter what aspect of the hobby, whether you're whether you're into DXing, whether you're into public service, whether you're into homebrew, it all revolves around communicating with another human being. And I think that's really the common thread in amateur radio. As with most hobbies, it's it's a connection. I think we all have the desire on some level to connect to other people, and that's really what I think drives it.
Well, you know, I guess the thing, the technology has gone crazy. In other words, we got so much technology. And I guess I want to say that all the different facets of ham radio gives you an opportunity to communicate with other people on all sorts of different levels, using different platforms and whatnot. And, you know, I guess, but all in all, you know, without the other person at the other end, there's not a whole lot of point in fooling around with it, you know.
No, exactly.
And really, when you get right down to it, that's what the antenna business is all about, and it's just about communicating. Your company, though, I noticed on the website, you're into some other things other than just antennas. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, our tagline is antennas, positioners, and accessories. Initially known for our antennas, and of course that is the name of our company, is M Square Antenna Systems. But the positioners and the accessories are the systems part of it. Pretty much anything on the from the feed line back from the radio, amplifiers, sequencers, preamplifiers, anything that you can imagine that would be part of an antenna system. Anything that you could mount on a tower is something that we do. We make heavy-duty azimuth and elevation rotator systems. We make a couple of this is something that I'm really excited about is our new solid-state amplifier line. We've just launched in the last couple months a solid-state amplifier for 2 meters that puts out 1.2 kilowatts, and it takes up less space on a desktop than a microwave oven.
You were talking about a 1.2 kilowatts on
1.2 kilowatt amplifier, solid state, and it fits perfectly on a desktop. It's smaller than a lot of rigs.
Our special guest today, Jason Boyer, N6EY with M Squared Antennas, and we'll be right back with Jason right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however, rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something. It's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's hamtestonline.com. Is it possible that a coffee roaster who has been blind from birth could make the best tasting coffee in the world? Well, I'm here to tell you that not only is it possible, but it's true. If you would like the most delightful, rich cup of coffee you have ever drank in your life, I'd like to invite you to visit the website of The Unseen Bean. That's The Unseen Bean, UNSEENBEAN. TheUnseenBean.com. Jerry Leary, amateur radio operator, shortwave listener, he is the owner of The Unseen Bean, one of the country's few blind coffee roasters. You will love his coffee. We want to invite you once again, go to his website, and that's TheUnseenBean.com. That's TheUnseenBean.com. Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website and put on that email, I want to win, because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, I want to win. Once again, our guest today, Jason Boyer, N6EY. He's with M Squared Antennas, and boy, this is an interesting show. And let's continue on QSO. I wanted to ask about this because I've got, you know, we've had people on as guests, and we've had people sending email and whatnot. For a person, let's say a person is wanting to get into EME.
That's our specialty.
Okay, now we see these huge antenna arrays, you know, where you've got like multiple Yagis all ganged together and pointed up there at the moon and whatnot. But for somebody that just is just starting out and wants to get into this and play around with it to test their interest to see if this is something that they want to do, what is the bare bones? Where can you start in working with EME? With basics, where is that at? What is absolutely required, the bare bones minimum, for someone to point an antenna at the moon, give their call sign, you know, and then hear the thing come back to them a few seconds later?
Well, I tell you what, the easiest way to get on the air is with an out of the box radio. A lot of people have radios like the FT 857 or the 897. The ICOM 7000s, any all-mode VHF radio with either 6 or 2 meters will get you on the air. And the antenna doesn't have to be super elaborate. A single antenna on 2 meters with 9 or 10 elements can be enough to start. Increase the number of people that you can talk to as you build your system, but just to get going, it doesn't take a whole lot. Really, it's more with sound card modes, with low signal level equipment. You can really get on the air in just a short amount of time and with not a lot of expense.
Well, if you had an all mode transceiver. And let's say 2 meters because it's probably the most popular of the VHF UHF bands. Let's take a Yagi antenna. How many elements would you have to have, and how much power would you have to have? And does the elements do they need to crisscross? Can you use just one polarization, or do you have to have both polarizations? How does all that work?
Well, the easiest way is to start off with a single polarization. A lot of people use horizontal polarization. And an antenna, just like our 2M9 SSB, is perfect to start out. A lot of people are not aware that you can take advantage of certain physical properties of the way waves reflect by putting an antenna, for example, at a certain height above ground. You can take take advantage of something called ground gain, which will give you some apparent, not true gain, but it's apparent gain. It's something that helps you receive a little bit better, and with the moon at a low angle on the horizon, 100-160 watts, like you might find from a simple brick type amplifier, is more than enough to get you started.
So, what would a person, the average ham, expect with a single Yagi pointed at the moon? But now, let me ask you this, though: you wouldn't be able to do that or get those kind of results with the moon, say, for example, up in the air at 1 o'clock or something like that.
Exactly. And when you grow in the EME hobby, it's almost its own hobby. It is pretty addictive. One of the things that you find is, okay, now that the moon's risen, I can't talk to it anymore. How do I raise my antennas? And that's when you start looking at a couple of different things. First thing you want to look at is elevation. With a simple elevation rotator, you can change the tilt angle of the antennas and point them toward the moon. And at that point, maybe you want to start talking about building up your system a little bit, and you can add a second antenna, and by using a power divider and the correct phasing cables, you can increase your signal by up to 3 dB, which is effectively a doubling of power, both on receive and on transmit. Further, some things happen on the way to and from the moon that kind of rotate the polarization of signals. So that's where you start looking at cross polarity. So then we get into another antenna, which is something that I would say the larger majority of people starting out at EME really start with, and that's a cross polarized antenna. Typically, they'll use two of those antennas side by side to be able to switch between vertical and horizontal polarization. And with the two of them combined, you get about 18 dB of gain, and it really enhances the number of people that you'll be able to talk to from the moon.
So even with a single Yagi, what you're saying is that when the moon rises, is it the fact that the moon is at a higher angle, or if you could move that single Yagi to be dead on the moon, then does it make any difference as to where the moon is in terms of position in the sky?
It does make a difference. The closer onto the moon that you get, the better your signal is going to be. The better you're going to be able to talk to other people. You'll start to see as the moon gets out of your beam width. For example, the 2M9 SSB Yagi has a beam width somewhere in the neighborhood of about 26 degrees or so. Outside of that 26 degree window, once it gets above that, the signal drops off initially by 3 dB and then exponentially after that. So what the user will see is they'll see the signal start to get weaker, and then it just drops off.
Well, I understand that. I would think that the beam width on a Yagi pointed at the moon would be really narrow. I mean, I think you'd have to be pretty well dead on target in order to get any kind of results. But what I was saying is, if the moon is on the horizon, mm-hmm. and you have one single Yagi, you're aimed right on it, okay. And then as the moon progresses up, and I'm just going to use the example, it's at 1 o'clock. If that same Yagi is then moved and aimed dead on the moon at 1 o'clock. Would there be any difference in performance? In other words, does the moon being closer to the horizon optimize it some, as opposed to being, straight overhead?
With a single Yagi, it does. With a single Yagi, it does. Once you combine antennas into arrays, the ground effect is offset by the gain that you actually get from stacking the Yagis. So you don't quite see the performance jump that you would expect with the single Yagi. So there is a little bit of a trade-off there. But the advantage is, at that point, typically, once you start stacking antennas, then you're getting more gain from the antennas themselves. And also, you're at a point where you're probably looking at elevating the antennas and following the moon.
Well, see, and that's what I was, my question was, and that is, is it just a matter of the antenna being focused accurately on the moon, or does the path change with the elevation of the moon. In other words, as the moon begins to rise, even though the antenna may be dead on the moon, and you may have an excellent tracking system, with one single antenna, you're going to get that gain from it being at a lower angle. In other words, there's something happens.
Absolutely.
Okay.
You're gonna get more gain from being at the lower angle, and as the moon, of course, moves, you have to match that. You have to match that. Otherwise, you do lose it.
So for the moon up in the air, so to speak, let's listen to this, up in the air. For the moon being located, say 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, you know, some position that's up pretty high, and to be able to effectively do EME, then at that point, what's the bare minimum? In other words, are you going to need at least two of the Yagi antennas, maybe cross polarization? And then, do you need more power, or if you had the two antennas with cross polarization, is 150 watts still adequate? I should say, in order to do this, or are you going to need a little bit more power? You know, to
at that point, two antennas on a small elevation rotator, we make a nice one, the MT-1000, that will. That'll actually allow you to grow into some very decent size arrays, but a lot of people get started with something a little smaller. There's some smaller elevation rotators out there that are also used for satellite work, and for two antennas, they're fine. And we actually start a lot of people off with that system. That's again probably one of our most popular things, is to take two antennas with cross polarization on a small elevator and use that with 160 watts and a mass mounted preamplifier. That really is the real basic entry level. I'm getting started. I'm going to talk to quite a few people on EME kind of system, and you can get into that for relatively low money.
You know, I would think, you know, for people who are wanting to promote the hobby, I would think that an EME demonstration would be a real experience for someone to see somebody actually do EME, you know, for the first time and be introduced to amateur radio from that point of view. However, I want to ask this question, though. You know, so many times there's things that we do as hams that impress us, but people from the outside world, you know, they step up and look at that and they go, what in the world? You know, it's like single sideband. You know, he sounds like Donald Duck. He sounds scratchy, you know. It's like working DX. You know, they hear the fade and they hear the phasing, the multipath that comes in from, you know, from a distant signal. And for folks at first, it doesn't really intrigue them because they're like, well, why would I want to listen to that? I can call Germany on my cell phone, you know. I guess my question is, as far as demonstrations are concerned, basic entry-level type EME stuff, to the outside world, if you're trying to promote the hobby, is that going to be impressive, or is it going to be something that hams get, but the outside world is going to look at it and go, I don't know why these guys are doing, I don't know why they're making such a big deal out of this?
Well, I tell you, one of the most impressive demonstrations of EME is... It really comes with a big system. For somebody who maybe hasn't been exposed to the hobby of amateur radio at all, or just is asking that question, well, why would you do that instead of just picking up the cell phone or getting on the internet and Skyping? It's the real impressive thing is when somebody gets onto a big EME system, and as soon as you unkey, you hear that last 2.5 seconds of your transmission, and it puts a lot of things into perspective. One, it puts into perspective that the moon is a long way away, and that radio signal that seems to instantly get from the transmitter to the receiver actually takes some time to transmit, and you actually hear the distance of the moon in that 2.5 seconds. But the other question that's answered is, it's not about the destination, it's about the journey. It's about how you get there. And that's what makes amateur radio a lot of fun.
Oh, the reason why I was saying, you know, you hear people say, well, You know, why do I want to do that? I could just pick up my cell phone and call. You know, but it's not every day that you see somebody bounce a signal off the moon and hear it return. See, that I think that there's, in other words, that kind of spells it out. It's like, yeah, well, do that on your cell phone.
You know? Exactly. Exactly. I mean, that's your own personal way of interacting with the moon. You can't, it's out of the reach of most people's budgets to ever travel to the moon. But this is the next best thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a lot safer, too. I was going to ask you, you know, we're talking about EME, and I wanted to cover this because I've had so many people say, well, what does it take? A lot of the books that are written on amateur radio, I honestly think some of the authors have tried to make things more difficult than what they are. Why that is, I don't know. That's been my experience. You'll find some books are written that just flow, and you know, you read it, and you go, wow, is that all there is to this? I mean, this would be fairly simple and easy to do, you know. You pick up another book, and it's like on the same subject, and you would swear there's no way in the world I'll ever get this, you know. But it all boils down to, you know, an analogy I've used before, and that it's like trying to tell someone over the telephone how to tie a shoe. You know, I mean, can you imagine somebody that's never tied a shoe, and your job is to tell them over the phone how to tie a shoe?
I get that.
Very, very, you know, it's crazy. But now let's step back from the moon a little bit, because one of the things that I think can be, I guess I want to say, as impressive, but also as intriguing, and I get just as many people asking questions about this, and that is satellite communication. And
satellites.
How involved are you? I just want to say personally in the past or currently or whatever in satellite communication. You know, setting antennas up and making contacts and helping other guys do the same as far as satellite communication is concerned.
Well, I tell you, one of the first things I did when I got here was I was really intrigued by two products that we make is. It's called the egg beater antenna, and we make one for 2 meters and one for 70 centimeters. And these are omnidirectional antennas for low Earth orbit satellite communications. So a lot of the satellites, most of the satellites now that are launched are low Earth orbit satellites. And they kind of get the nickname Easy Sats because they're a lot less difficult to get on the air with than the older satellites that had some higher or some eccentric orbits that would take it way, way out into space and it can bring it back right back to Earth. The low Earth orbit satellites are in a constant orbit that holds, they're pretty much a circular orbit that they make regular passes overhead, and the passes are a little shorter, but it's more like, it's more along the lines of a repeater in the sky. So when I got here, I had these antennas, and the one frustration I had was, gosh, you know, I only have one mast, and it's going to be difficult to put one on one mast, and I go find another mast and put this other one up just for this other antenna, just so I can have uplink and downlink at the same time. And talking to our engineer Matt Stahl, and the sales and marketing manager Wyatt Leisinger, well, they both turned to me and said, well, just put them on a crossboom. And the sales side of me picked up and said, well, does anyone else ask for this? And the answer was, yeah, from time to time. I said, well, why don't we put this all in a package? And then it clicked. We had the antenna for 2 meters. We had the antenna for 70 centimeters. But by packaging them together, we could make a single product that somebody can pick this product up, connect it to their VHF, UHF radio, a dual band FM radio is fine, a multi-mode will work great on satellites. My first satellite contact was actually with an FT-817 and two of these egg beaters. Using a duplexer up at the mast, could bring one feed line down, get on the air, working satellites, no rotators, no positioning, don't have to do any fancy calculations. It's just easy, get on the air, and you're talking literally going into outer space, talking to satellites, and then beaming them back down to the Earth to talk to other people.
Now, with the satellites, we're still dealing with a situation where the satellite is in motion. A lot of people today, when we think about satellites, you know, they equate more to the stationary satellites that are up there for television and whatnot. So you point a dish up in the sky and you never move the dish. But with the amateur satellites, those things are in motion. So I guess my question is, what kind of get up do you folks have to track these things? And how hard is it to set up something that's actually going to track the satellite as it moves across the sky?
Well, I tell you that we actually make just about everything that you would need to track a satellite using a directional antenna. A lot of the satellites use circular polarization, so we have a line of circularly polarized Yagis for both 2 meters and 70 centimeters. And those are the two bands, incidentally, that are used primarily for uplink and downlink on satellites. We make those antennas, but we also make a crossboom to put them on. You need to have a non-conductive crossboom. We actually make a crossboom specifically to mount these Yagis on, in addition to some other hardware to help you route the cables and put these up on top of a tower. Now, somebody might ask, okay, well, that's great, but how do I turn these things? Well, there are a couple of options. We've actually made our fiberglass crossboom to work specifically with some less expensive elevation rotators that are readily available on the market, or you can use our MT-1000 elevation rotator along with our OR-2800 azimuth rotator that, when combined with the crossboom and the antennas, provides a complete satellite system that can that you can use in conjunction with your software to track and communicate with these satellites.
So the software itself, the software itself is, I guess I want to say, responsible for moving the antenna system and following the satellite. In other words, let me equate it to this. A lot of folks that have, over the years, have done a little bit of, astronomy stuff. They've got a telescope. And some folks, fortunate enough to get a telescope, they would have a clock drive on it.
Correct.
And the clock drive was set up to turn at a speed where you could actually point it at a celestial object. And if the telescope were lined up properly, it would actually track something, because a lot of folks don't realize when you point a pretty good-sized telescope up in the sky at an object, you've got a limited time to look at it unless you plan on, and then if you've got any degree of amplification from the telescope at all. Now, I happen to have a 10-inch Dobsonian. And I love the thing. I think it's just one of the coolest things I've ever played with. But, one of the things that a lot of folks don't realize, they'll come over and I'll say, hey, you want to take a look at, some deep space object or something in the sky, a nebula or something. And they're shocked at how fast the thing moves. They say, wow, it's already out of there. I just started looking at it. It's gone, And that's not because the object's moving, it's just simply the rotation of the Earth. So it's fairly simple, I would think, to rig up a motor drive that causes to follow an object in the sky like Saturn or Jupiter or something like that to compensate for the rotation of the Earth. Relatively simple, because that is a constant and whatnot. But now the satellites, they're moving on their own, so that's a whole different action besides the Earth's rotation. You've got whatever it is that they're doing. Why don't you describe that a little bit and talk about how these things are able to track that?
Well, that's a great question, Ted. One of the things that has to be considered when tracking these is that each of these has an orbit that it follows. They're at a specific altitude above the Earth. They have what's called eccentricity, and that's the Earth's not a perfect sphere, and neither is the orbit of a particular satellite. So one of the first things that happens after the satellite is put into orbit is it's tracked by NORAD, and it's actually assigned a set of numbers called Keplerian elements. Now, you might recognize the name Kepler from the astronomer Johannes Kepler, who actually determined, it was a pioneer in determining, hey, you know what, things actually orbit. They have predictable paths and orbits, which in his day was heresy, but now we accept it as fact. But these Keplerian elements define the orbit of a satellite so that at any point on Earth, by knowing the exact time and the exact date, we can predict exactly where that satellite is going to be. So by knowing that, a computer program can actually predict the orbit. It can determine the time of the pass. It can determine where on the compass that the satellite will appear to rise on the horizon, and it'll tell you where it's going to go overhead and how high it's going to be, how long the pass is going to be. So that software has to track that satellite and point the antennas in a position so that it'll catch the satellite as it comes up on the horizon and then follow it overhead until it disappears again back down on the horizon somewhere else in the sky.
But now all the satellites that are up there, although optimally you would want to track them, but they don't necessarily have to be tracked like that because you're talking about these egg beater antennas that are omnidirectional.
That's correct.
Now my question is, you know, do they have a narrower window of communication with the satellite as opposed to running, say, Yagis on some motor drives that are set up with a computer to follow the things?
Anything with those antennas, they're actually designed to push the pattern up just a little bit. So, on the horizon, you have a little bit of clutter down on the horizon, whether it's trees or other structures or anything. So. What we find is anything with a pass below about 8 degrees might be a little bit below the pattern of this antenna. But from about 10 degrees on up in the sky, so for most of the sky, for most of these nice overhead passes where we have a nice long pass to work with, these antennas are great.
Now let me backtrack here. Now with EME, how long of a time do you have to operate? Even with let's say a fairly elaborate system, you've got something that's pointing your antennas at the moon, and it's going to track the moon going across the sky, or the Earth turning, I should say. You know, I guess I'm going back to medieval times here. with that going on, how long of a window do you have? I mean, what?
You pretty much have upwards of 12 hours.
So you can operate, you can work via the moon for a 12-hour stretch if you've got the equipment to track and follow. Now, these are, I would imagine, people think of doing EME on clear nights, but, I mean, I would assume that, cloud cover has nothing to do with it as long as you've got the goods that can track the moon, whether it's visible or not.
That's correct. As long as you have a good idea of where the moon is, you don't have to see. If you're a little overcast, a little hazy, even with the new moon, you can still work the moon. You just have to know where in the sky the moon is.
But now the phases of the moon, does that affect anything, or is that just our ability to see the light? In other words, only a portion of the moon appears to be lit because of the way it's positioned and where the sun is and all that, but that doesn't really affect its ability to reflect because we're not or have I got that wrong?
Well, no, actually, for the most part, you're right. There is a little caveat to that, though, is that there are certain times where you have, especially with the full moon, where you have a little bit extra noise. There are actually some noisy parts of the sky that add to the moon. So it may not necessarily correspond with a phase, but it has more to do with where in the sky the moon is, and that determines how much background noise there is. So you can always communicate off the moon as long as you can see the moon. The difference is how well you can communicate.
Okay, now, contrasting that, what is the average time you have to communicate via satellite? You know, I mean, how long do you have once that satellite is, I guess I want to say, above the horizon as far as your line of sight is concerned? Now, it's going to sweep across the sky at one angle or another. What is the expected time? How long have you got to really communicate over one of these things?
You have on average about 6 to 12 minutes.
Well, that doesn't make for rag chewing.
No, I like to equate a satellite pass as a mini contest.
What do you say? 599 goodbye. Okay. But that's interesting. See, because once again, I can see that's a whole facet of the hobby. But I guess the other question I have is, how many people are there to work? Now, for example, if you got up and say you put all the stuff together to work satellites, I mean, could you sit there day after day after day and just come up with endless numbers of contacts with people that you're talking to? Or do you find it's just a set group of people that are up there operating all the time?
Well, you'll run into some familiar faces, familiar call signs from time to time, but one of the neat things about satellite is there are so many people that are interested. It's so easy to get on the air. Simply a handheld with a long whip antenna can work some satellites. So when you get a pass, especially with a bird, one of the most popular birds was AO-51, and unfortunately that bird has ceased operations. So I think it's been stricken even from AMSAT. The bird is when that bird would go overhead, I mean it was just a madhouse. There were so many people on because it had such good coverage, had a great orbit, had a nice strong transmitter. Very sensitive receivers. It was a very well-maintained bird, and AMSAT really got a lot of bang for their buck. So, yeah, there are a lot of people out there to talk to, and occasionally you do get the chance to rag chew. If you get a late-night pass where most people are in bed, you may only have two or three people on, and you do get a chance to chat a little bit and say hi, how are things over in your part of the world, that kind of thing, and a little more than a grid square and a 599. So there is a lot to do on there, and it's definitely growing a popularity. We see it a lot.
Now, I guess let me ask this: if you have switch modes, let's say you're off of voice and you're doing packet or whatever, then you know you could probably make at that point with satellite. You could probably make a whole bunch of contacts in a different mode other than voice.
Absolutely. The easiest mode to get onto is FM voice, and that requires just a little bit of technical skill to get going, but it's not out of the realm of possibility for most amateurs. Getting a little more technical, you do have packet, and that's kind of an interesting mode in itself, because a lot of packet is store and forward, so you'll check into essentially a bulletin board or a mailbox in the sky, and you post a message up there. And then as the satellite orbits around, you can actually deliver a message to someone anywhere in the world. And what will happen is you'll send the message up to the satellite, and it'll carry that message until that person checks in and retrieves the message. But there are other modes. A lot of people use single sideband and CW on some of these satellites, and that requires a little bit more skill.
That's now, of course, most of this you're saying is it's a combination of 2 meters and 440.
Correct.
Okay. Now there are those radios that are built, and I purchased one of them not too long ago. I don't know where it's at. We can't find it, but we have lost radios in our house. I mean, we're currently looking for an HF transceiver in here that we can't find, as well as this dual band radio. But it was 2 meters and 440, and it had the ability to receive both bands at the same time. Somebody pitched me on that. So if you want to. This is a good radio because it'll do satellite work. I said, well, why is that? Well, it'll receive both bands at the same time. Now, tell me, why would that be an advantage?
Well, especially when you're working on CW and single sideband, you have something you have to account for. These aircraft, there's no air, they're spacecraft. These vehicles are traveling at 17,000 miles per hour. There's an effect called the Doppler effect, and that is a change in the frequency relative to the receiving station because of the speed, the velocity of that spacecraft. Now, when we're traveling mobile in our vehicles, there is a slight shift in frequency of our mobile of our radio signal, and it's a lot like the shift in the tone of a horn of a car. As it's coming toward you, you can hear the pitch of the horn is higher than what it is as the car's going behind you, and that's because of compression and decompression of the wave.
All old sound effects records have had train whistle, trains going on. You hear the train come, pass by you, and the pitch change. I mean, I think that's just been a standard sound effects record with a train. If you follow what I'm saying, you hear that change immediately.
Exactly. That applies to radio waves as well. And so something else that has to happen with especially with single sideband and CW, to a small extent the FM transponders as well, but with single sideband and CW, tuning is very critical. Anyone who's used single sideband or CW on HF knows that if you bump the knob just a little bit, it completely changes the signal, and if you go too far, you completely lose the signal. And that's the same effect that happens with satellites. As a satellite comes overhead, the frequency is actually higher by several tens of kilohertz than it is when it's directly overhead, and it continues as it passes overhead to get lower in frequency. So by having a radio that can receive and transmit, that can receive on one band and simultaneously receive your downlink, that's going to give you the ability to hear your signal, to make sure that you're tuned onto the satellite, that you're getting into the satellite, and that you're tracking the Doppler shift properly.
Well, that's interesting. I wondered about that. I never asked the question, but it's something that I was just never involved in, never did. Actually, to tell you the truth, you know what? As long as I've been an amateur radio, I've never witnessed someone working a satellite firsthand. Never been there. But I guess there's a lot of things in this hobby. That was so interesting about ham radio. You could be in ham radio for 100 years, you know, and never still see all the different things actually physically operate. You know, you hear about all this different stuff, and yet you don't necessarily see it. You know, but you understand that it's there, and you understand how unusual and, you know, how cool it is. Now, let me ask this question now. Let's go down this road a little bit. You were talking about noise. When you mentioned, we were talking about, you know, the moon and whatnot, and you said, well, there's a certain amount of noise that you might hear. How about listening, utilizing the antenna systems that you folks make to listen to celestial objects in space? I mean, radio astronomy is an area all unto itself. There are people that are just completely ate up in that as a hobby. So I'm just guessing and saying you've got to have come across those folks, and you probably do some business with them.
We do. One of the things that a lot of radio astronomers, and as a matter of fact, one of our market segments on the commercial side is research and science. A lot of customers come to us for positioning systems. It's very critical to have a high degree of accuracy and a high degree of stability in pointing an antenna, and that's something that we're known for on our commercial side is building positioning systems that can track a point in the sky as the Earth rotates and hold it to within a few tenths of a degree or even more.
What are some of the objects in the sky? Let's just say that a person gets onto your arrays for doing satellite work and whatnot. Let's say we're going to just point these antennas somewhere and track an object in the sky. What are some of the most prominent objects that you could actually pick up and receive radio signals or radio noise from? That would be the simplest, easiest things to look at.
Well, the number one simplest thing would be something that it's our nearest star, and that'd be the sun.
Okay.
A lot of radio amateurs are getting into amateur radio astronomy, and one of the things that a lot of people are really interested in is what's going on in the sun. How does that affect propagation? What happens on the sun directly affects us, not only in terms of light and heat, but also it affects our space weather. So, by measuring certain frequencies, especially in the 10.7 centimeter band, you can actually determine the solar flux and see what's starting to happen and what might happen as far as sunspot eruption, solar flares, that kind of thing.
So in the 10 centimeter band, you're listening to that. Does that come to you in the form of noise, data? Can you look at it, let's say, with a graphic display? How would you go about studying this or making heads or tails out of what you're getting?
It actually comes in the form of what looks like noise, and it's really radiation directly from the sun. So by following the pattern and the noise levels and the trends with a calibrated receiver, most amateurs are using a small dish. A lot use a recycled direct broadcast satellite dish, like you might use for DirecTV or Dish Network. I think I want to give them equal coverage. I don't want to show any favoritism toward one or the other, but by using one of those type dishes and a home built feed with a receiver. You can actually find out what's going on in the sun.
Well, but let me ask you this question. I don't know how steerable or how you probably make things that would steer something as large as an older C-band dish.
Oh, absolutely. Some of our amateur systems could do that. Something a little larger like our MT-3000 would drive such a dish. It would require some extra mounts, but it could drive that in both azimuth and elevation.
As far as antennas are concerned, you don't sell any parabolic type antennas that are used for any of this.
Nothing in the product line as of yet. Nothing for amateur use.
You see, I would think, from just working in the broadcast business, aiming a parabolic dish can really be a pain. Especially if you get into a really large dish, people would think, well, the bigger the dish, the easier to aim. It doesn't seem to work out that way for some reason. Why is that?
Well, hold on a sec. One of the reasons is because the beam width of that dish is so narrow. It's so tight. You're talking about having about a 3-degree beam width. And that requires a degree of precision and control that it's not easily achieved, but it can be done.
I was going to say because a Yagi is so much easier to aim and hit the target than a parabolic type antenna. A parabolic antenna to me would be I can have nightmares. About those things, trying to aim them on an object, or like a satellite. where a Yagi is, and obviously you don't have as much gain, but boy, it sure is a whole lot. It's a lot wider and a whole lot easier to aim.
It's a barn door compared to a big dish like that.
Well, one of the things that I want to talk about this because all aspects of amateur radio, but you folks also manufacture HF antennas.
Yes, we do. And that was actually how we got our start, was in HF.
Well, the thing that I guess HF antennas have always been somewhat of a mystery in terms of above, like, say, 20 meters and up. But you folks make, I saw in your catalog, you make a full-size 80-meter beam that goes on the top of a tower. And, I looked at that and I thought, oh, my gosh, not only does that have to be huge, I'd like to just see one of those things up in the air on top of a tower, let alone own one.
It's going to be a big tower, let me tell you.
Well, and the thing is, though, that with a lot of guys that, let's say, operate 80 meters, a lot of people will drop the same amount of money they would spend on an antenna like that on a large amplifier.
That's right. And what a lot of people don't realize is that, when it comes down to the decision between buying a bigger antenna or buying an amplifier, dollar for dollar, you get a whole lot more bang for your buck by going with the antenna.
Well, what would a person notice on 80 meters if you had, typically, how tall would the tower be that you would put that 80-meter beam on? In other words, would there be an optimum height? I would assume there would be.
You want to try and get at least a half wavelength above the ground. That's where you're going to start to see directivity. You're going to start to see less interaction with the ground and more of the directional effect of the antenna. So that's going to put it up at about 130 feet or so. But the trade-off is having a much stronger signal. You're going to hear a whole lot more. A typical three-element antenna, you should have somewhere in the neighborhood of about 8 dB of gain, which is a gain of more than four times. 6 dB is a gain factor of 4, so you're probably talking somewhere in the neighborhood of about seven times.
Now, that antenna, how would you get that thing to the top of the tower? How typically, I look at that and I think to myself, I can't think about the size of it alone is enough to throw my thinking off. But now here comes the chore. You assemble this thing on the ground. How much does it weigh and how difficult is it to get that antenna up to the top of a 120-foot tower?
Well, I tell you, to put it in scale, it's not unheard of to install that antenna with a helicopter.
I see. That has to be a fairly serious individual.
It is. Something along the lines, for a full-size 80-meter antenna, it isn't uncommon to see somebody install it with a helicopter. Most will go the more traditional route and use a crane, but it has been done with a helicopter, and that's for somebody who really wants to put that kind of hardware in the sky, that's certainly a viable option.
Well, let me ask you, you said a full size. Now, do you make anything smaller for 80 than a full size? Is there such a thing as a loaded?
Yes. That's one of, for many of our HF antennas, especially below 10 megahertz. A lot of people are looking for something that, maybe it has a little, it's a little lighter, has a little less loading, and we use our more common 80-meter antenna is a linear-loaded antenna. And the linear loading is kind of interesting because instead of using coils and traps, it actually uses a linear loading element that breaks the element in half and shortens it. And instead uses a pair of parallel lines that add a loading effect. So you do have some inductance and some capacitance like you do in a trap, but it's a whole lot more efficient. It's a lot cleaner design. Mechanically, it's every bit as strong as a trap type setup. and the performance is a lot higher.
So how large are one of those antennas as you compare it to the full-size 80-meter antenna?
Well, a full-size 80-meter antenna is going to have element lengths around 130 feet or more. A linear loaded antenna is going to be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 100 feet.
So it does
shorten it.
It shortens it some,
25%. Yeah.
Well, what about Let's go down the line here and let's talk about 40 meters. Which for some reason, I think 40 meters is probably my favorite HF band, and for one reason, and that it seems to be there all the time.
You know, it is.
All the rest of the bands go and come, but 40 is there all the time. And I guess 30's that way on CW to some degree, but 40 is like, 40 is like your friend, you know? It's always there, okay? What about 40-meter beams? I mean, are they a lot less? I mean, can you get a linear-loaded 40-meter beam and get the size down to something that's somewhat manageable for the average guy?
Oh, yeah. A lot of people are using our 40-meter beams. One of our most popular is actually our biggest, and that's a 40M4. It's a 40-meter, four-element, linear-loaded antenna with a dual-driven element. So it's kind of a neat antenna that actually the design had its roots back in the KLM days, and of course we've updated it and put our own spin on it, made it a lot more mechanically secure. The max element length on that's right around between 50 and 55 feet, so you're talking about a much more manageable antenna and something that a lot of people can put on top of a 80 or 90 foot tower.
That that makes a lot of sense. I think the idea of getting what's the difference? A guy who's been running a dipole forever, and he puts one of these up on the tower. What is going to be the biggest noticeable change? I mean, obviously it's going to collect more signal, but what other little nuances do you notice from a beam that you would miss on a dipole?
One of the interesting things that I hear when somebody's describing an antenna is, I can work everybody I can hear. Well, that's true with this antenna. The trick is you're going to hear a lot more people, and you're going to be able to work a lot more people with this antenna.
With the differences, I mean, we have Yagi antennas, but I noticed that you are also making log periodics.
Yeah, the log periodic is becoming more popular. It actually was popular a number of years ago. Became very popular in the 80s, and then people started going more toward multiband Yagis. Now they're a little bit different. They're both beam type antennas, and they're both directional. A multiband Yagi has elements that make the antenna work on a few different bands. So you might get one, say, that has 20 meters, 15 meters, and 10 meters. But with the log periodic, you get coverage over a more or less a continuous range from one frequency to the next. And the way that happens is, this is actually, the full name is a log periodic dipole array. And what the antenna is it's a series of dipoles that are all fed from the same feed system. But they periodically get smaller and smaller as they go from the back to the front. And what that does is that adds a lot of different resonant elements that make the antenna. It gives it a little directivity, but it also gives you a more even SWR, more even performance across the range. So, for example, one of our popular antennas is we call it the 7 and 1030 LP8. That antenna has eight elements. It covers the range from 10 meters down through 30 meters continuously, or 10 megahertz through 30 megahertz continuously. It gives you coverage on all those bands. Plus, we've added an element at the back that gives coverage on 40 meters as well.
But how big is that thing? how large is it?
Well, I tell you, you'd be surprised at how big this or how small this antenna really is. One of the things to consider is, how much space do I have on the tower? Not only horizontally going over your neighbor's yard, but vertically as well. And a lot of people find that, they run out of space pretty quickly when they try to put everything onto one tower. So this antenna actually comes in at a surprisingly low. It has the max element length on it. It's a 40 meter element, and that's 49 feet. But the boom length is only 29.5 feet.
So that's relatively small in comparison to what most folks are used to having to deal with. As far as boom length is concerned, boom length is usually the determining factor as to whether you can get the thing in the air or not.
Exactly. So with a turning radius of actually only 28 feet, it'll fit in most city lots. If you can get a permit for a tower, this might be the right choice to put up on top of your tower to get coverage from 40 through 10 meters.
Now, I let me ask this question. Let's just say you take a log periodic antenna, and for the sake of the average ham operating in the average backyard with a tower, let's talk, 20 through 10 meters.
Okay.
Now, my question is, what are going to be the differences in performance between a log periodic that will do 10 through 20, so, and everything in between, as opposed to monobanders, like a 20-meter monobander, 17-meter monobander? What's going to be the, I guess I want to say, is there any compromise there? Is there something you would notice?
You're going to give up a little bit of gain by going to a log periodic. You don't get something for nothing in this world, and that's absolutely true when you're dealing with physics. If in an antenna, you can either have bandwidth or you can have gain. You typically don't have both, but with a log periodic like this, a typical Ford gain is about 5.2 dBi. So you're looking at a gain factor of somewhere between somewhere right in the neighborhood of about 3 to 4 times the base signal. So for 1 watt in at 5 dBi, you might see somewhere in the neighborhood of about 3 watts out off the front, and again that's apparent gain. There's no magic. It's just the way that the energy is directed. With a monobander on 20 meters, just our basic 4-element 20-meter antenna would give you a gain somewhere in the neighborhood of about 7, or actually 9 dBi. So you'll get quite a bit more gain. You'll get almost twice the gain with just 4 elements, and that's on a relatively the same size boom. You're talking about a 35-foot boom. So you get more performance out of a monoband, Yagi, but you give up the versatility of switching from band to band to band.
Okay, now, for those that have never given this any thought, okay, let's take the 4-element monoband beam, and you say the amount of gain that you would see on that, say typically on a 17-meter or 20-meter beam, would be about what?
A 4-element 20-meter beam would give you right around 9 dBi. Or about 7 dB over a dipole.
Okay, now, because I'm very poor at calculating, I'll impose on you. Let's just say that you're on the 17-meter band, and let's just say you're running the legal limit, okay? And you're on that 4-element monoband beam. What is going to be the effective radiated power coming off of that antenna in its main lobe?
So given that the legal limit is 1,500 watts input, if you put with a gain of 7 dB, which is right around, I'm reusing round numbers here, with a gain factor of 5, 1500 watts in will look like 7500 watts coming out.
So you're looking at a signal of about, 7500 watts ERP coming
Correct.
Off of that antenna. See, now what a lot of people don't realize, I know you've heard it said, and I know you've heard it talked about on the air, or you're listening to people, and they'll say, "Well, that's a 100,000 watt FM radio station there in whatever city it is." You know, that's one of those 100 kilowatt FMs. You know, well, most of those 100 kilowatt FMs have transmitters that are putting out somewhere between 10 and maybe 25 kilowatts. Most of them are not approaching anywhere near 100 kW on the transmitter side. But that power is made up by means of antenna bays and antenna gain. So when you hear this story that, hey, that's a 100,000-watt radio station, it really, in reality, the transmitter is only maybe 10 to 20 kilowatts. Okay. So the other thing is, I don't think hams sometimes think about the fact that they do have an effective radiated power. Just like an FM broadcast station. If you stop and think about the effective radiated power, it kind of puts things into perspective a little bit.
It really does. It really does. And that's an interesting thing about that, too, is unlike a broadcaster, a ham will transmit, but then when they're done transmitting, they receive. And one of the things that makes an antenna a better value in many cases than an amplifier is that not only do you increase your transmit power, your effective radiated power, but that same gain is applied to receiving as well.
And that's something, I guess I want to say a lot of folks seem to have the opinion that, the more power they run, the more people they can talk to. But the problem is what happens when you're transmitting over the top of the noise, you've still got to receive through that noise. And, of course, a directional system is going to cut the noise back because you're only going to be getting noise from one direction as opposed to, 360 degrees of noise. The other fallacy, I think, and I know you said you make preamps, but another fallacy, I think, is a lot of times people think, well, if I run more power, all I have to do to increase my receive is to put a preamp online. And that, when do preamps work? When is the best time and appropriate places to use preamps where you're not going to, in other words, I've seen it to where you throw the switch, the signal comes up, the noise comes up. In effect, all you've done is turn up the volume. So I mean, when can you use a preamp, and when can it make a difference?
Well, that's a good point, Ted. One of the things that I think that you hit it right on the head is it's a misnomer that if you just throw a preamp on, you'll be able to hear more. And the answer to that is maybe. It works really well at VHF and UHF because as we have long feed line runs, a lot of times that signal is lost. So by amplifying the signal at the antenna, you put more signal on the line. So if a little bit's lost, hey, we still have enough to work with at the receiver. The other time a preamp works is if your receiver's not so great, if it doesn't have a great front end and you need to add a little amplification. But most of the time when folks use a preamp, they're not amplifying the signal as much as they're amplifying the noise. And that's why it's important to use a preamp, but use it sparingly because you may not do anything to improve your signal to noise ratio.
Well, that was one thing that I had noticed. I mean, going back to the typical little linear amplifier would contain the main RF output, and then they would also throw a little preamp in, as a bonus, so that when you when you're transmitting, you'd flip this preamp on, and you'd see the meter pop up. If a guy was, he'd go from S9 to 20/9 or something.
Exactly.
But then, I was never impressed with preamps because I'd always say, well, yeah, but listen, the noise went right up with it. Everything went up. I mean, other than turning up, you could have done the same thing by turning up the volume. But there is something like, for example, now with the AGC on receivers, a lot of times when there's lots of noise, you can gain a lot of clarity by turning the RF gain back. Because what happens is the AGC action on the receiver causes the background noise to jump up and be almost as high as the actual signal you're listening to.
Absolutely.
Now, let me ask this question, because you folks make preamps. Are there any preamps made that kind of do that sort of thing? In other words, that have the ability to not mesh the noise with the main signal?
Well, one thing that happens with preamps is that anytime you have a semiconductor device, a transistor or a field effect transistor, something that's used as an amplification device in a preamp, you have noise. There is a small amount of noise that's generated. So you'll see one of the specs that people look at when they look at a preamplifier is, first one they look at is what's the gain on it. And you might see a gain of 30 dB from a preamplifier, but the noise figure is probably as or more important than the gain figure of the preamp, because if the gain figure is high, if you have 1 or 2 dB of noise or of a noise factor, why, that's going to detract from the effectiveness of that preamp. So one of the things that we did with our preamp, we make a low noise preamp for 2 meters. One of the things we did is went out and found the lowest noise device possible, and our RF engineer Ken Holliday, he was actually the K in KLM back in the KLM days. He and Mike still worked together, and Ken actually designed this preamplifier to have a noise figure of less than 0.4 dB. And what that means is that it virtually adds no extra noise. Now, we do the trade-off is that we dial the gain back a little bit to get that noise figure, to keep the noise low, but we've also included a generous amount of gain on the order of 20 to 22 dB of gain on that preamplifier. And what that is, that preamplifier will still put plenty of extra gain on a signal to not only overcome any front-end deficiencies of the receiver, but also to get through the losses that are in the feed line going back to the radio. The result is, for very quiet signals, for very low, very critical communications, such as with EME and weak signal terrestrial work, you'll get a nice increase in the amplified signal. You won't have much of an increase in background noise.
Well, you know, another thing, I had heard someone talk about this, and I don't know how valid this is, but they were talking about preamps having headroom. And I thought, well, why would you need headroom on a preamp? And they said, well, let's just say you're trying to listen to a weak signal, and on the band, off and on at the same time, is a much stronger signal. So if you've got, and I don't know, this may have to do with adjacent frequencies or first adjacencies or something very close to the signal that you're listening to, that another very, very strong signal could drive the preamp into a situation where the thing you're trying to listen to can't be heard. Even though you're not necessarily listening to the stronger signal, it's still coming in through the threshold of the preamp, and if the preamp does not have enough headroom, that can cause a problem with the signal that you're listening to. Now, is there any validity to that at all? I mean,
there is some that really happens more in the AGC circuit of your receiver. It can to some extent happen in a preamp, but it's only typically when the gain of the amplifier is designed at the device's limits.
Well, that was a question that I remember somebody asking that, and I said, I haven't got the slightest idea, because I couldn't equate headroom to a RF preamp. But I guess if the RF preamp is broadband and it's picking up signals say, up the band somewhere that are just banging the daylights out of its front end, then that will affect the fundamental frequency that you're tuned to on your receiver, because it's going to affect the gain and probably the distortion products or whatever that preamp is going to put out because of being overloaded by, say, a stronger signal up the band somewhere. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I wonder, because you're making these things. So I would imagine you have much more cognizance of that than I do.
That's actually a good point, Ted. And that really what that really relates to is, and I think you touched on a key point there, is adjacent signals, not necessarily within the amateur band, but within the band of frequencies that's received through that preamp. And one of the things that we've done is a lot of times we'll find public safety, we'll find other users, businesses, commercial interests above and below the 2 meter band. So what we've done is we've actually added a helical filter to narrow the bandwidth that's passed through this amplifier, and that reduces the chance that a nearby police transmitter or a couple of walkie-talkies down at the local Home Depot are going to get into your into the front end of your very sensitive receiver and blow out that EME signal that you're trying to copy.
I was going to ask this question, and that is, in all the antennas that are placed in the air and all of the systems that people are using, what about grounding? You know, any sort of an antenna that you put up in the air, like some of the Yagis, for example, I guess the actual antenna itself is at ground potential all over, other than where the match attaches to it. What do you suggest, and what little tricks or what knowledge have you learned about ground systems, grounding your antenna? I mean, is it necessary to disconnect the coax when you're not using the antenna? Do we ever get to the point where we can leave home thinking, well, if there's a lightning storm, it's not going to hurt my stuff? What's your take on all that?
Well, I tell you, I spent some time in between my military and career in this position, working in telecommunications. And one of the things that you see at a lot of mountaintop radio sites is as a piece of coax enters a building, those sites, you can't disconnect the coax. And I'll tell anybody, there's no substitute for disconnecting a coax for lightning safety. If you disconnect the coax, you get it away from the shack, it will not enter your shack from that route. It might come in through the power line, it might come in through a phone line, but it's not going to come in through your antenna if there's nothing connecting the antenna. Unfortunately, that's not always practical. I would say in most cases it's not practical. Thunderstorms, especially in the southeast and the southwest, they come up quickly and without warning, and they're usually swift and severe, and sometimes we're not home to disconnect it, or sometimes it comes up so quickly it's not safe to go disconnect that. So taking a lesson from these remote mountaintop sites, everything there comes in at a single entrance point. All the coax shields, the shields at that point are bonded to ground. And a lot of times they'll use a gas discharge tube or a carbon block type suppressor. Polyphaser makes a good product like that. But they're used right at the end, right at the point of entry, and a good single point earth ground is put in right there to drain any kind of lightning strike to ground.
You know, I noticed the cell companies, for the most part now, here's something they're doing. Now, see if you can follow this, see if, if you got any suggestions. A lot of them, of course, they'll, around the fence line, where their tower is, they'll have rods on the ground all the way around that fence line, then they ground the fence. But also, I've seen them take copper strap and go out in four directions, 25, 50 feet, and then after that, they go to a ground rod, and then another 50 or 75 feet of soft-drawn copper wire, and then at the end of that, there's a ground rod. So they have basically a pretty good surface contact with the earth at the base of this tower, and several of those guys I've talked to said that that's the name of the game, is surface contact, not as much as grounding in terms of driving a stake in the ground, a copper rod in the ground and attaching to it, but more like, you know, copper strap close to the surface of the ground, stretching out a ways, serves to discharge anything that may be trying to build up. Now, I mean, have you followed any of that, or have you seen any of that approach at all?
Well, I have to confess that we out here in Central California, we don't get a whole lot of lightning, so we follow that just a little bit less. But I think there is some validity to that, and if nothing else, you could take a look at who's doing it. If they're copper's expensive, and if they're spending to put in that kind of a ground system, there really has to be effective, and there has to be a reason behind that.
Well, I guess the thing of it is we're all interested in protecting equipment from lightning, and although the majority of lightning comes in through the AC lines, oddly enough, a lot of people don't realize that, but, you know, direct hit to an antenna, it happens, but it's not nearly as common as everything getting messed up by being connected up to the power grid, you know.
That's correct. So there's no substitute for good surge suppression protection at every... at every part of your shack, any point of entry, any easy path to ground for lightning is going to be exploited, and that's usually where you're going to find the damage if there is a lightning strike.
Now, I want to ask a couple other questions technically here that would affect operation of a ham station, especially with DX and that sort of thing. I'd like for you to talk just a wee bit, or talk about takeoff angle and how it affects transmissions, and when it is that you would prefer a high takeoff angle, and when would you like a low takeoff angle, when is either one of them advantageous, and how do you achieve that?
Well, that's a good question, Ted. One of the big debates is among antenna users, it's some insist I have to have the lowest takeoff angle, and my answer is, well, what are you trying to do? And for most people who are trying to DX, who really just trying to get every mile out of their signal that they can, a low takeoff angle is usually the right answer. And there are a few ways to do that. It's not quite as practical, but it's sometimes done even at HF as stacking beams. By placing one beam over another and feeding them in phase with through a power divider network, you can really, really lower the takeoff angle to almost 0 degrees. By bringing that down, it increases the skip zone. It flattens out the signal so that as it bounces off the ionosphere, it bounces off at a much further point. It increases some of your skip zone, though, so the point from the transmitter site to the next point where it's seen at the ground may go out longer. So what happens is, if you're interested in a little bit closer communications, you might find that you're skipping right over the top of some of those people, and you don't see, and you aren't as effective in communicating. So things like local nets or regional message handling, that kind of thing, that might suffer for the sake of a little bit better DX.
I've seen these antennas. They purport to be NVIS antennas for like 40 meters and whatnot. I guess the question is in your antenna line, though, it looks to me like you're more interested in, especially in the HF line, you're more interested in the lower takeoff angles on those higher bands.
Correct.
Than you would be, I mean, I don't know what the advantage would be for an NVIS antenna on 20 meters or 17. It doesn't seem to me like it would make much sense. I mean, can you effectively ever communicate on those bands with people 100 miles, 150 miles of you, or is that just even crazy to think about stuff like that?
It's possible, but not it's more difficult to do, and there are better ways, better frequencies to use. A lot of people are using 40 and 80 meters for NBIS, and whether by design or by necessity, a lot of those frequencies, a lot of antennas for those frequencies inadvertently become NBIS just because they're so close to the ground. And that enhances local communication. So a lot of nets, you'll find the MARS, the military, I think now it's called the Military Auxiliary Radio System, just a recent change in the last few weeks. They actually use NVIS on the lower frequency bands to affect regional communications. So there is some advantage to that, but on the higher frequencies, I think for the effort to get a higher takeoff angle, I don't think that's most would find that not worth it.
Well, Aki, now let me ask a question: where do you see antennas themselves and your company in general? What do you see in the future? Where is amateur radio and the antenna business heading? What do you think we're going to see more of over the next few years, and where should people be looking?
Well, I think your people today are looking for a good value. They're looking for performance, but they're also looking for something that they can more and more looking for things that can be. That can be used on a smaller city lot with more restrictions, or things that are more portable that can be taken out into the field so that somebody who lives, say, in a condo association where you can't have any antennas at all can pack up a few portable, decent-performing antennas, take them up to a hilltop, take them out to a park, take them to the beach, take them to wherever, set up and have fun. And I think that's kind of the trend that we're starting to see.
In your line, what do you have in that line of what you consider to be portable antennas? People that are living in places that are homeowner association ran where they think that, you know, a tower in the backyard is just nothing but an eyesore, which is totally, completely misguided and a complete sure sign of lack of something, but we won't go down that road. I won't say that, okay? I won't say that those people are misguided and, you know. What do you have along that line? What could you steer people to?
Well, really, there are so many different things that we could, that we could point folks to. A lot of, we've seen a big interest in, among our de-expeditions, We actually have a de-expedition program. We see a lot of people 6 meters, especially between the solar activity and just this time of year being it's 6 meter season right now. We see a lot of people going after 6 meter antennas and even 2 meter antennas for VHF contesting. So we have a lot of we have several antennas in the line that are designed to be low cost, easily portable antennas that you can put in the field. You don't have to spend a lot of money to have a nice high quality antenna. Our SS line, we have a 3-element 6 meter antenna, the 6M3SS, and we have a 2 meter counterpart, also 3 elements. The 6 meter antennas list for $164, so it's very affordable. The 2 meter antenna is even less, so it's under $100.
Okay,
so
now really, you know, we've come off of this horrible sunspot lull there, where everybody was predicting that the sun was going to die. You know, they were saying something's wrong with that thing; it's not working right. You know, now all of a sudden we have solar activity. So what about 6 meters? I mean, there's a lot of people have never operated 6 meters and have no idea what it's capable of, and they don't really understand and know the differences between it and, say, 2 meters, that they're maybe more used to operating or working. And some folks have had, you know, some experience on 10. But talk about 6 meters. I mean, you've got antennas that'll do 6 meters. What can a person expect to do these days with 6 meters?
And I tell you, 6 meters is called the magic band for a reason. It's a kind of band that you, especially during the summer months, because of the way the Earth's rotating into toward the summer with the northern hemisphere pointing toward the sun, get increased solar activity, so we get these pockets of ionization in the E layer of the ionosphere, and that's what we call E skip. And you'll hear that, you hear E skip season a lot. And what that is it's a patch of ionized particles that you can bounce a signal off, and where you would normally have line of sight coverage, a band that's almost that sounds dead 80% of the time, all of a sudden will spring to life, and you hear signals from hundreds or even thousands of miles away, and work DX just like you would on 10 meters during a good opening. It's possible to work from the States, working into Hawaii or Japan, or going the other way and working into Europe and Africa. It's just completely amazing, and you just never know what you're going to get with 6 meters.
Well, I recall a guy having an older, I mean, I'm trying to think who made this thing. Maybe it was Lafayette Electronics when I was a kid, and they were on 6 meters. They were only running 4 or 5 watts and talking to New Zealand as if it were next door.
Yeah. Yes, you absolutely can.
And of course, you know, with the sunspot cycle being what it has been, 6 meters, I don't think, has been a real popular band for, say, like local communications. But let's talk about that for a minute. Let's just say that you're not using a repeater. Do you get any increased simplex range between stations on 6 that you wouldn't see on 2?
You do. You actually get a little bit better coverage, primarily because 6 meters isn't as affected by trees, by buildings. Has a little bit better penetrating power, so you do see some advantage to communicating on 6 for local communications. It's great in wooded areas, and a lot of search and rescue units and a lot of public safety still use frequencies near the 6 meter band to communicate with their units in the field.
Well, I know a lot of folks were scared of it years ago because it used to just tear the daylights out of Channel 2 VHF television. You know, you turn on a 2 meter, 6 meter rig, and just take the neighbors right out. You know, they're watching Channel 2 in some city somewhere. They were gone. You know, and they were forming a lynch mob to come after you.
Exactly.
But in the car, I mean, the antennas are not big, and even as far as the home is concerned, you're still dealing with very small antennas. And I wondered about that because, you know. Sometimes, I mean, the HF bands are kind of impractical, and you're right. 2 meters, you'll run into picket fencing and the trees and whatnot. If you get kind of a little bit better of a break in that, and I've often wondered why then is it that 6 is not used more for local communication? I mean, I just wonder why the emphasis on 2 meters as opposed to 6 seems like if you're tooling around town and you're talking, you know, base to mobile or talking to somebody else, you know, and you're in the car, it just seems like 6 meters would be the natural for that.
Oh, absolutely, and that is a good question, and I have my theory might be that it's a proliferation of surplus commercial gear that's made 2 meters more popular, but there's so much to do on 6, and really need to need to increase the activity, get on there and try it out. There's just a whole world of stuff out there.
Well, I mean, I guess I can understand that because for years, you know, we had all these old Motorola rigs and all the 2 meter gear was, you know, police gear, 170, 150 megahertz converted, you know, to 2 meters. And it was, there was a glut of it. It was cheap. It was all over the market. You get your hands on it real easy. And I remember the first time I ever heard 2 meters was an old commercial rig like that, but it was really broadband, a lot broader than what you hear now. And the audio was just absolutely incredible. It really impressed me. And of course, now it's not that wide. The audio bandwidth for 2 meters is pretty narrow. But those first old radios I heard back years ago, they were, the audio was just extremely impressive on those things. They were, they were high fidelity, you know.
Oh yeah, they were, they were nearly broadcast quality. I mean, they were just, they were something else.
Well, listen, I don't want to take up your whole day, but we've had a good time talking. I guess the thing I'd like for you to do is, you know, is there anything in particular that you would like to bring up or talk about that has to do with M Squared or the hobby in general, or just anything that that you'd like to say or express that maybe we haven't covered in our conversation here?
Well, I'd just like to let everyone know that we are here. One of the things that we pride ourselves on in our customer service is that you can always get somebody here. So even if you just have questions about antennas, if you have you know, maybe an idea, or you think you want to, maybe you want to try 6 meters and you want to find some, we have antenna solutions from you know, from small omnidirectional antennas all the way up to giant EME arrays that we can build for you. And we have prices that run the whole spectrum from next to nothing all the way up to, you know, however big you want to go. We're always here, and, you know, we're here for the advice, so please give us a call, check out our website, but by all means, enjoy the hobby. That's what it's here for.
Okay, let's give the URL for the website for starts.
Okay, so the URL is http://www.m2inc, that's letter M as in Mary, number 2inc.com.
And if you go in Google, you can simply type in M Squared Antenna Systems, and it comes up, and you'll find them. The other thing is the, we were talking about, you know, customer service, and I'll tell you, boy, it's a pet peeve of mine. I could go off like a loaded shotgun. It seems like everywhere we go today, the thing that really is suffering is customer service. I don't know what's going on, but our society has got some real problems. So when you run across a company, when he says, we answer our telephones, you know, I was telling him earlier, I said, you know, I was tempted to put on a voicemail that says, you know, thank you for calling. If you would like to blow up this voicemail system, press 1. I think that would be hysterical, you know, because a lot of times, you know, and then the ones, you're really in trouble when you call and they say, now listen carefully because our menu has changed. Now, you know, you got trouble right off the bat. They've added 50 more combinations of things. You know, okay, if you want this, press 3. Okay, I'll press 3. Okay. And then the voice says, oh, now you have a choice of A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And if you want such and such, press 4. Okay, you press 4. All right. And now another voice comes on and says, now, if you want this, but, and I'm telling you, they get you in there 10 levels deep. And then all of a sudden, you know, your cell drops and you got to start all over again, you know, and by the time you're over, I don't know. I know folks, you're listening. You've been there. You know what I'm talking about. What Jason is saying, that doesn't happen when you call this company. For the most part, if there's a person available, they're going to pick that phone up and answer it. They're not going to sit at their desk, you know, and sit there and screen the calls. Well, I want to talk to this guy. Do I want to? The game, I guess I want to say the main focus at this point is customer service, and that's everything to your gain is to have somebody on the other end that really does want to talk to you and communicate with you. And I guess that's your focus at this point. And I want to say, you know, you're inviting folks to even call and just ask general antenna questions if they have a question about antennas of any kind, to give these folks a call. Now, how many folks are there? I mean, who will they talk to if they do call?
Primarily, you'll either talk to primarily three of us. There's myself. There's the sales and marketing manager Wyatt, KF6VMW, or the general manager Matt Stahl, K6KIG. So chances are you're going to pick up when somebody picks up the phone, it's going to be one of the three of us, and it's going to be you're going to be talking to a fellow ham. So by all means, call us. That's what we're here for.
All right. Once again, N6EY, Jason Boyer is our guest. M Squared Antenna Systems. This has been a real enlightening conversation, and I know there's a lot of folks that have gained a whole lot out of this and listening and have probably gained a different perspective on a lot of different things. But once again, let's give out your website so that folks can find it easily, and tell us once again what the URL is, and if you have an email address or something they can contact you through.
Okay, and that's www.m2inc.com. And the email address, if anybody's interested, is sales, S-A-L-E-S, sales at m2inc.com.
All righty. Thank you so much. This has been very enjoyable.
Thank you, Ted. Thanks for having us on. We really enjoyed it.
One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20. For like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at QSO, we really need to hear from you. We would appreciate it if you would go to our website, QSORadioshow.com. That's QSORadioshow.com. Send us an email from the website and put on that email, "I want to win," because we're constantly giving neat things away. QSORadioshow.com. Also, we'd appreciate it if you would follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And if you'd friend us on Facebook, QSO. QSO Radio Show. We'd love to hear from you. Be sure and do an email to us and put on that email, "I want to win." Well, that's all the time we've got for QSO today. And, of course, we'll be back next week, same time, same station. And we'll be broadcasting live from Field Day. So go to the website and check it out, the times, the frequencies, and be sure and join us. Thank you for listening to QSO.